طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. This morning we take a look at the weaponization of the law to launch an offensive against organizations and projects which support the Palestinian resistance to the occupation of their homeland, in this case, through the right-wing pro-Israeli lawfare project. We focus on the analysis and significance of the lawsuit that lawfare brought against the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, a coalition of pro-Palestinian organizations here in the United States. We join the U.S. Campaign's executive director, Ahmed Abuzneid, and their attorney, Diala Shamas, of the Center for Constitutional Rights. The conversation is kicked off by the Foundation of Middle East Peace's Laura Friedman in their podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Occupied Thoughts, a podcast brought to you by the Foundation for Middle East Peace. I'm Laura Friedman. I'm the president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace. Today is February 10th, 2023, and it is my honor and pleasure to be here with Ahmed Abuzneid and Diala Shamas. I'm going to do quick introductions and then we'll get right into it. And for folks who are joining us, the title that I have at least temporarily given to this podcast is Lawfare in Action, the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights as a Case Study. I try to make these catchy. I'm not good at coming up with titles. So quickly, the bios. So Ahmed Abuzneid is the executive director of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, otherwise known as USCPR. The U.S. Campaign, Ahmed co-founded the Florida-based Dream Defenders after the killing of Trayvon Martin, serving as legal and policy director and COO during his time there. Ahmed went on to lead the National Network for Arab American Communities as the executive director from 2017 to 2019. Welcome, Ahmed.
Hey, thank you for having me, Laura.
And alongside Ahmed, we have Diala Shamas. Diala is a senior staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, CCR, where she works on challenging government and law enforcement abuses perpetrated under the guise of national security, both in the U.S. and abroad. Prior to joining CCR, she was a clinical supervising attorney and lecturer in law at Stanford Law School and a senior staff attorney supervising the CLEAR, that's Creating Law Enforcement Accountability and Responsibility, project at CUNY School of Law. Welcome, Diala.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you both for being here. So I've invited Ahmed and Diala here today to discuss the lawsuit that was filed by the Jewish National Fund against the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. This was back in 2019. This lawsuit was actually dismissed by a U.S. federal judge in March 2021. We're going to talk about all of that. But the bottom line is that that has now been appealed and oral arguments were heard last month, January 2023. We're going to talk about that too. And overall, what we're going to talk about with this case is what it's really about, what is underlying this case, what arguments are being made about it and in it, and what it has to say about the efforts by pro-Israel or pro-Israeli impunity forces to instrumentalize and weaponize U.S. laws to target and suppress Palestinian activism and solidarity more broadly. So we're going to just dive right in. Ahmed, I want to start with you, and I want you, for the sake of this audience who maybe cares a lot about lawfare, we've done a lot of podcasts and webinars about lawfare, but may not be familiar with the U.S. campaign. So can you introduce the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights and its work, please?
Absolutely. So the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights was founded just about 21 years ago by a bunch of folks in the U.S., including Palestinians in the U.S., that wanted to see a future where the U.S. would no longer financially, diplomatically, and militarily support the occupation and ethnic cleansing going on in Palestine at the hand of the Israelis. And so folks concerned with their tax dollars, with their elected officials endorsing and supporting what's now being rightly called an apartheid system, was something that these folks set out a vision and a mission to end. And so that is why we're around. We want for U.S. tax dollars to be utilized responsibly. We want for our foreign policy, which according to this administration is to be centered around human rights, to actually apply to the Palestinian people as well. And so we're Palestinian led. We're able to work with folks from the grassroots to the Hill. And we really are, you know, hopefully a part of a movement that's seeing some impact, but greater impact to come in these next few years. Excited to be here, Laura, and we'll get into some of the in-depth conversations in a few.
Fantastic. That's a great way to start off. So now, Diala, I want to come to you, and I'm right away off the bat going to give you permission to go on a little bit longer with this answer, because what I want you to do is run down the nitty-gritty of what people need to know about this case. And I will also say, as you are beginning to think about how you're going to answer that, what's a very long answer, I'm going to include in the notes with this podcast and webinar, I actually have links to all the different case documents that you may be referencing. So people who listen to this and think, well, I'd like to read that for myself, it's all going to be there. I've already pulled it together. So Diala, run down the history of this case, what it's really about. And I'm just going to say off the bat, you know, I read about this case. I was actually in Haifa when this broke in the news, and I read about it in the paper, and I'm like, well, this sounds like a pretty nutty legal theory, you know, of accountability, why somehow U.S. campaign is somehow responsible for something that happened on the Gaza border. So I want you to just like break this all down and explain what is really going on here.
Absolutely. I'll do my best and I'll try to not go on for too long, because as you said, the documents are all, you know, in addition to linking to them, they're all available on the CCR website. But just first of all, big picture, this case is like a prime example. In addition to being nutty, it's a prime example of all of the things that we have come to describe as lawfare sort of in one place. The use of the courts to target advocates for their advocacy, the specific focus on the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, and the use and abuse of U.S. counterterrorism laws and the whole framework to be sort of weaponized against Palestinian advocates. Like, these are sort of core features of the lawfare project, and they're all here evident in this case, which...
And we're going to get into all of those later into the conversation. So I'm glad you mentioned them. Okay. Make a note. We're going to come back to you on that.
So the case was first filed, as you noted, in 2019, and it's brought by a group of Israeli plaintiffs. The sort of lead plaintiff is the JNF. It's actually Keren Kayemet Leisrael, which is the Israeli JNF. Keren Kayemet Leisrael is the sort of Hebrew word for Jewish National Fund. And that's a sort of a quasi-state entity in Israel. It holds through some legislation and some, you know, the way that it's structured, actually holds lots of the lands of Israel in collaboration with the Israel Land Administration, I think is the term.
Israel Land Authority, the ILA.
Authority, thank you. And along with a group of other dual citizens, so Israeli-American plaintiffs, they sued the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights for material support to terrorism and some other accompanying torts. So the entire complaint, which is sprawling, and you're free to go and look at it on our website, it's 62 pages, over 200 paragraphs, really rests on only two things. They only claim two things that the U.S. campaign actually did. So this is the basis of their theory of liability. One is that the U.S. campaign was a fiscal sponsor for the Boycott National Committee. And so the Boycott National Committee, for those who don't know, is the sort of coordinating body, NGO, for the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement, which is, of course, a much broader thing. And the second set of allegations of what the U.S. campaign did were citing to the complaint cites to tweets and emails that the U.S. campaign for Palestinian rights sent around to their supporters or out to the public, in support of the rights of protesters in Gaza who were marching to the Israel-Gaza border during the Great Return March and a series of marches, and we can get into that a little bit later. So those emails and those tweets are things like condemning the use of lethal force against unarmed protesters, uplifting the fact that the protesters are demanding the right of return, you know, so like core protected First Amendment activity, the exact kind of advocacy that, you know, you would expect an organization called the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights to be undertaking. But based on these two things, the rest of the complaint is a whole series of these attenuated linkages that they connect through several frames, several degrees of removal, but trying to connect the U.S. campaign for harms that allegedly flowed from the Great Return March. To try to summarize it, and it's really this convoluted set of allegations, but that the Boycott National Committee consists of multiple organizations, one of which is also a coalition of multiple organizations, some of which are foreign terrorist organizations. And this is a key part of, you know, where the material support to terrorism law comes in. The foreign terrorist organizations are the Palestinian political parties, most of which have been political factions, most of which have been designated by the United States as terrorist organizations. So through these various linkages, they try to argue, not successfully, that the U.S. campaign is somehow supporting terrorism and therefore liable for harms coming out of Gaza. There's plenty that's wrong with this theory. At any point, if you look at this kind of chain of connections, we don't need to get into each one of those junctures, but the judges did press during oral arguments on appeal in January. The judges did press the lawyers to sort of try to clarify what their theory of liability was. And I don't believe that they had a very good answer to that. And the main, the thrust of the sort of totality of answers and arguments is that we need more discovery in order to clarify our theory, right? So that's what gets at the sort of purpose and the real kind of thrust of these lawsuits is it's a form of harassment, and that's at the core of what lawfare is. The plaintiffs argued repeatedly below at the district court level, as well as on appeal, that they need to be able to, you know, to get documents and, you know, subject the plaintiffs to all sorts of invasive discovery and questions and see their papers and their files and all of that to be able to properly litigate this case. And that's just not what the law allows them to do. There's well-established precedent in U.S. law that protects litigants from this kind of intrusive and harassing lawsuits. There's all sorts of protections that are there, but as a threshold matter, and what was coming up here was at a motion to dismiss, you can't really pass this threshold. You can't really get discovery unless you've pled something, and here you just haven't pled enough. You haven't made the necessary connections to get the kind of want. But they repeatedly asserted that they needed that discovery and they wanted that discovery. And, you know, our perspective is that's sort of that was the main purpose for bringing this litigation and harassing the U.S. campaign.
So it sounds like, go ahead.
I can't really also miss the second main claim that they had. This wasn't on appeal, but it was at the lower level, which was citing to the U.S. campaign's alleged participation in something called the Stop the JNF campaign, and saying that their participation in that is was interfering in their is a tort, basically. So suing them, and the basis of their lawsuit is that you participated in this human rights campaign, saying that what they have in their complaint about the Stop the JNF campaign is that it's intended to end the role of the Jewish and in presumably taking over Palestinian land. And so here we have, you know, the target of a human rights campaign suing the human rights advocates for their participation in a human rights campaign.
Right. No, that's great. It's funny listening to you. I love the word attenuated. For a long time, I tried to get people to buy into my phrase, which is 6 degrees of terrorist contamination, which I think is just too long to be catchy. But that's effectively what this is. It also sounds like you're effectively describing what is a theory of liability based on the need to find documents to back it up, which requires a fishing expedition, which generally is not something the courts like. I do want to mention one thing. When I was pulling through the documents, and I remember at the time the role of the International Legal Forum, which is an Israeli government-linked NGO. And I actually found the page they have announcing the case. And I just want to read it here, and people, I'll put the link with the notes. And it says, for almost 2 years, the ILF, along with our partners, have been researching the links between the BDS, their term, and designated terrorist groups with the aim to stop the funding and delegitimize this vehemently anti-Semitic and exploitative movement. In November 2019, using this research, the ILF, which again is related directly to the Israeli government, has worked directly with them. The ILF prepared and recruited Karen Kayemet Leisrael together with a group of terror victims in suing the U.S.-based charity Campaign for Palestinian Rights for $90 million in damage. Damages caused to property and environment, as well as emotional harm. So this is basically claiming credit for generating and organizing a lawsuit from an Israeli lawfare NGO that is directly related to the Israeli government that's been involved in other lawfare activities, which I just think is fascinating. Okay, so going forward. So I want to come back to Ahmed. I'm going to go back and forth between you. Feel free to jump in if you guys want to expound on each other's answers. So Ahmed, as we've already been saying, this is a case of lawfare. And we've seen lawfare before. We saw the lawsuit against the Carter Center and Norwegian People's Aid. And other. So I want you to talk about the way lawfare has been used and is being used to try to target and silence other grassroots movements, not just Palestinians, and how that experience is being applied to or applies to this case.
Yeah. I mean, you know, first I'll say shout out to our attorneys. I think Diala and Maria and CCR and our entire team of attorneys clearly help us to feel confident, you know, in these times where you have these sorts of challenges that we didn't get into the movement to be prepared to fight, right? When you're an activist or an organizer, you know that justice is on your side and you want to advocate for that change and shift that you know is going to be for the betterment of humanity, betterment of the world. And so this is something that I think the opposition is simply, you know, throwing everything at the wall and seeing what sticks. And it was a term, you know, some terminology I learned back in law school, which is just, you know, utilizing the law to figure out what mechanism can work for you and what can't. But in the meantime, if these mechanisms, you know, aren't successful in the courts achieving the demand that they'd like to seek, you know, it slows folks down from doing the organizing and the activism, you know, that we're here to do. I'm a Palestinian born in Palestine who has a U.S. citizenship that no longer wants to see tax dollars of mine and my friends and family members utilized in occupying and ethnically cleansing my people. And I have a constitutionally protected right to demand that. And guess what? There's a lot of people who feel the same way in this country. And so what the opposition is doing, what the right-wing forces are doing, is trying to stifle debate, trying to stifle the shift that we're witnessing in modern time. And as it relates to other movements, we've seen this with Big Oil's attacks on water protectors and environmental justice advocates. I mean, of course, some of the folks that were defending their lands against the Dakota pipelines, you know, we're seeing a lot of like this material support or, you know, allegations of terrorism, as opposed to recognizing them for what they are, advocates for justice and humanity and freedom and liberation, you know, things that, you know, most of us can really get behind. And so the best way to make sure folks aren't able to get behind that message is by stifling that message, by muddying that message, by alleging things like terrorism or material support. But you know what? We know that justice is on our side. And again, we have great attorneys. And so we're not going to be, you know, dismayed by that.
Thanks. And yeah, I was thinking Dakota Pipeline when you were talking. Then I was also thinking about what's happening in Georgia right now, where you've got the environmental activists being hit with domestic terrorism laws, which is if people, you read the complaints, some of those are quite extraordinary. I suspect lawyers are going to have a lot of fun with that, actually. Okay, so Diala, I want to come back to you as counsel on this, but also someone who's been working on this, I know, with a whole range of cases for a long time. you already mentioned material support. At the root of anti-Palestinian lawfare in the U.S. is often the allegation of violations of U.S. laws regarding what is called, I'm putting it in quotes, material support for terrorism, which has, you know, you would think that has a specific meaning, but I guess courts have been interpreting it however they want. Can you explain about these material support laws? What are their origins and history? And I, since I know the answer to that a little bit, I'm going to say, and given their origins and history, how has it happened that they have come to be exploited almost certainly, I won't say exclusively, but certainly primarily as a tool for targeting Palestinian activism and solidarity?
Thanks, Laura. So I think there's two stories about the origins and history. One is the one that we talk about a lot, which is, and it's connected, thank you for bringing up the Georgia protests and the domestic terrorism, the use of domestic terrorism practices here. So that story is, material support to terrorism was really kind of came online with the passage of the AEDPA, Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act. And that was a response to the Oklahoma City bombings, right? So in response to this act of white supremacist violence, Congress passed this sweeping law. And as often is the case, the primary, the folks who borne the brunt of the consequences of the things that became criminalized or the changes in that legislation were communities of color, whether it's on the immigration front or in the criminal and on the criminal side of things. So material support to terrorism is one of the things that was in AEDPA and that then has since been expanded. And so that is a criminal law, criminalizes supporting materially supporting terrorism, but that definition of material support is really broad and has been used and wielded in all sorts of ways. Primarily, if you look at the way the primary sort of targets of the deployment of this criminal law have been, you know, Muslim communities in a sort of post 9/11 world. So I guess the first part of the answer about the origins is like we see this kind of flip of laws that were intended to target white supremacist violence, then be primarily used to pass laws that that have a disproportionate effect on communities of color. But the other story behind the sort of U.S. counterterrorism apparatus and the designation authority, the various kind of designation schemes that are out there, which connect to the material support to terrorism in order, because a designated group needs to sort of come into play to kind of activate the terrorism, the material support provisions. Those have anti-Palestinian discrimination at their roots. So if you look at the origins of a lot of these kind of designation schemes, Palestinians have always been the first ones on the lists, and then you see them kind of expand and grow. So I think that that's like an undertold aspect of this here, and it certainly is a big part of the story when you look at how, in many ways, this like next generation of material support to terrorism. It's not a next generation, it's been around for a long time, but the sort of use of civil lawsuits by private actors to drag folks into court. So that is a piece, you know, material support to terrorism I was describing is a criminal statute. And then there is through its interplay with another statute, litigants can walk into court and sue someone for material support to terrorism. And that law was expanded and supported by many right-wing and Zionist lobby groups to also reach aiding and abetting material support to terrorism. That's a long way to say we now have an avenue through which private litigants, Zionist advocacy organizations, kind of to try to drag folks into court or threaten them with potential litigation in order to like chill their support for Palestinian rights. And a core feature of this, of course, is the fact that most Palestinian political parties and factions are designated as foreign terrorist organizations, including, you know, Hamas, which is a de facto government in Gaza, and all of the other, you know, political parties, basically. So the ability to kind of lodge these complaints, even if they have no kind of real core, but just simply kind of trying to weave these kinds of connections with multiple degrees of separation and sometimes no actual degrees of, like, no, you know, there's like not even like a through line there, which is the problem with the analogy of 6 degrees, is because it's not like there's actually even 6 degrees.
That's a really good point. Thank you.
Yeah, it's hard to like think about messaging around these questions.
I was thinking the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, because at the end of the day, I have no connection to Kevin Bacon, and yet somebody can do a 6 degrees, which ends up being like both of your last names appear in the first 10 letters of the alphabet kind of thing. They're like, that's the connection.
Yeah, yeah, we can keep working on how to talk about this, but ultimately,
let me ask you. The what you're describing sounds to me as a non-lawyer a lot like SLAPP litigation. These are SLAPP suits, which are strategic litigation for the purposes of stopping public participation. I remember the word stand for, but I mean, is that a big piece of this?
Yeah, absolutely. And you see it in other contexts too. I mean, this is what is deployed against Palestinians and increasingly other groups because of the material support to terrorism provisions and how it interplays with where are folks who are designated like operating. But as Ahmed was saying, in the US, you know, there's all sorts of like use of RICO and other kinds of theories of liability with other kind of core crimes that aren't necessarily material support to terrorism. And those are all SLAPP suits.
Right. So the sort of lawsuits that have a chilling effect, because even if you're going to win them, the person who's filing them wins, whether they win the case or not, they win by making your life miserable and costing you money and reputational harm and forcing you to focus your energies not on the work you are supposed to be doing, but on fighting the litigation, which is a good segue to my next question for Ahmed. So clearly the goal, I think, I don't even think the people behind the litigation would disagree. The goal of this lawfare against the U.S. campaign is to weaken or destroy U.S. campaign as an organization and to undermine and delegitimize and, if possible, put an end to the work of the U.S. campaign. So that's the goal. Again, I don't think even the people bringing these cases would disagree with what I just said. So bearing in mind if that's the goal, what is the actual impact on the work of the campaign?
Well, I mean, you know, first you were kind of touching on it with a couple of your comments, there's a personal impact, you know, that, you know, the days when that lawsuit was served, the folks that were on staff at time, you know, kind of had a gut check moment. They kind of had a moment of, okay, what do we do to respond? You know, is my job, you know, is my organization going to be shut down? Will I have a job? You know, what is this going to do for my reputation? Right. You know, one of the interesting things is like, it, you know, we're talking about lawfare today, but even when you think about like websites like Canary Mission, you know, I've had family members and friends reach out to me and say like, how could they say these things about you? You know, how can they say these things and make these allegations about you? I know you're fighting for what's right. I know you're, you know, fighting for justice. And so there's a huge personal impact that, you know, the folks that were in the organization at the time had felt, and the folks that, you know, are in the organization now, you know, have felt. But, you know, there's also like Charity Navigator, some of these, you know, websites that we have our information around so that donors can know that they're donating to a trusted source. You know, some of these websites then had to have, you know, sort of notices that, you know, we're being sued because of XYZ. And, you know, so at times, you know, these allegations, these lawsuits can strike at the confidence of donors and supporters. You know, that's some of what we were worried about. But, you know, I have to say that because I think one, the U.S. campaign has a righteous and just mission, and two, because our people on the ground in Palestine here in the U.S., our supporters all across the U.S. are so committed that they weren't swayed. And so we actually, you know, while we were worried, you know, what will this do for, you know, our relationships and our ability to engage the Hill, for instance, or our ability, you know, to fundraise, what we've seen is folks have really just recommitted to the support of the U.S. campaign for Palestinian rights, to recommitted to that cause. And I think last year was a huge testament to that.
That's really heartening. I was actually thinking about the U.S. campaign. There was a report that came out a few weeks ago that one of the U.S. organizations that acts as a fiscal sponsor for some groups doing work on the ground in both Israel and Palestine, there was a letter that had been sent to the Treasury claiming that they're violating U.S. material support laws for funding two organizations, neither of which is on any OFAC list. And it's not the first time they've done this. I mean, I think the first time they sent a letter was like 3 years ago. And these organizations are still not on any OFAC list. And I'm thinking, I wonder how much pressure this organization is now going to come under. And they work worldwide. Essentially, what they're being told is we're going to continue to impose the most vicious reputational harm on you if you continue to work in Israel-Palestine. So you can either keep doing it and fight and refocus all your energies on defending yourselves, or you can drop work in Israel-Palestine. And I think it's just it's a horrible thing to – it's a horrible position to put groups doing good work in. But I'm heartened by your answer. Okay, so I want to sort of look sort of more broadly. So we've already touched on a lot of this, and you mentioned Canary Mission, Ahmed. You know, the lawsuits, slap suits, whatever you want to call them, are one of multiple tactics we're seeing to dissent, to silence dissent. And you also mentioned Diallo RICO suits. These are essentially claiming an illegal conspiracy to stop business. This was used in the Dakota Pipeline case, I believe. So Diallo, can you talk about what other kinds of legal lawfare tactics you're seeing, just a little more detail, and how groups like CCR are pushing back on this?
Sure. Well, even just with regards to, and you referenced some of these, but in the context of material support, like the use or the deployment of material support to terrorism in the U.S.'s overbroad counterterrorism framework, there's all sorts of ways in which that's deployed that aren't actually lawsuits. And so it's worth just noting that. You mentioned letters to Treasury, efforts to get groups' tax status revoked. But even letters to the Department of Justice, you know, flinging around these same accusations with no merit. But as Ahmed's saying, you know, these things turn up on the internet, they get into the echo chamber of these right wing websites, and then that turns up if you Google search someone. So all of that is kind of used to sort of cast a cloud over Palestinian advocacy. And so it's really important to be clear about how that is a project. It's baseless. There's no actual kind of legal harm that can flow from most of the stuff. It's just casting things, you know, the word terrorism has a way of like sucking the air out of the room and really scaring people, whether it's potential funders, whether it's college grads who want to go into the profession, you know, that whole thing. So that's one way we see it. We regularly get calls from folks who aren't sure whether or not they should be engaging in whether it's funding or being involved in, you know, a campaign or something, because they'll read these kinds of accusations online and they want to know the scope of their potential liability. So that is itself potentially a chilling effect. That said, I think that there's like two sides to that story, because I think it's intending to chill. I don't know that we're only seeing, you know, growing movement for Palestinian rights. And I think that people are able to kind of navigate this reality and still effectively do their advocacy. And that is what our organization and other groups like Palestine Legal, as well as other legal organizations and individual lawyers, are sort of just trying to do, is like create that space, tell folks about their rights, make sure that nobody, you know, is like actually facing legal jeopardy, and allowing people to kind of continue doing that activism. Other kinds of tactics we've seen, and some of my colleagues have been involved in decades litigation, targeting, you know, the Olympia Food Co-op is a good example. That case, after passing a BDS resolution, they were sued. And I think that it was on procedural grounds. It was, you know, saying something about the way that that BDS resolution passed, and they were dragged to court for 10 years. Ultimately, they were, you know, we prevailed, but that was still a decade long litigation. So that's time, that's resources, that's movement resources. There are plenty of other cases.
And it's people's lives. I mean, for 10 years, this hangs over you.
Exactly. you know, we see, I think I mentioned folks trying to get to like activate law enforcement and, you know, get the FBI to show up at a college student's door because they are being, they're receiving accusations, maybe anonymously or whoever knows how, that that person is involved in, you know, in some terrorism, obviously without much there, but even simply getting that door knock, right, can send a chilling effect. So there, I can't even list all of the ways in which we're seeing this. And I think you also track them very closely. So you should feel free to add here. But it's been a big and growing part of our work as a legal organization. And again, Palestine Legal is also doing a lot of this sort of important, like advising and providing resources to groups, because it's a reality. And it's a reality that we have to accept as a part of doing the work. But there are resources to provide that support.
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's a constantly mutating reality, right? So every time you sort of get a handle on one piece, something else comes up. There's a lot of there's an entire ecosystem of organizations out there that are devoted to constantly innovating new ways to go after Palestine activism. I would say, speaking to you all as part of the Palestine movement, that this is a great compliment, right? They're clearly very, very worried about what you're doing. But, you know, Ahmed, coming to you and just picking up on something that Diala just said, you know, she talked about you have to figure out ways to just navigate this reality and do what you're doing. So, I mean, you've talked, I think, quite passionately and compellingly about the work of the campaign and the commitment of the grassroots that's continued to support you. But how do you navigate this reality? How do Palestinian activists and allies push back and resist lawfare and keep doing the work? I mean, any insights?
Yeah, I mean, the first is, you know, we have to be honest, there's an assumption of risk here. You know, we know that it's been quite unpopular for some time in this country to engage in the sort of advocacy efforts that we have, but there's been a shift. And, you know, I like to reference the fact that when my father talks about his activism in his college days, you know, it used to be that there were protests, you know, against the Palestinian speakers being on campus. You know, the right wing pro-Israel forces had such a command over campuses, even, you know, that we weren't able to have that debate. But now it's actually the opposite. You know, our side has won over the debate so well that the protests are going on the other side, and Palestinian speakers and the Palestinian cause is being met, you know, with love and support and community, you know, no matter where we've been able to go. So I think one thing is to depend and lean on the experts in the field. Like Diala just really broke it down for us the way she's broke it down for so many of us in the movement before. And so, like, we want to continue to support organizations like CCR and PAL Legal. And so for us as US Campaign, any opportunity we get to talk about the work that our lawyers, our advocates, legal experts in our field have done is a great moment for us to uplift the movement, because this is real community driven work, and it's really responding to a need. It's responding to a challenge that the movement, you know, has had to deal with in these decades. And so what we want to do as a movement is continue to support the organizations that are doing the work, the experts that are leading in the work. And if their goals are to eliminate the U.S. campaign, you know, that means that, again, we're being pretty effective with what we're doing. We haven't accomplished our goal yet, but we can see that, you know, like Dr. King said, the moral arc of the universe is bending towards justice. And so we can see that on the horizon. And what we need to do is just keep pushing a little bit harder, keep pushing a little bit longer, and justice will prevail.
So that was a great mic drop place to end this, except I'm not ready to end it. So I apologize for continuing after your great. That was just like perfect ending statement. So for my listeners, our listeners, I apologize, but I got two more questions.
I'll try to say something better later.
So yeah, just think about a really good other Dr. King quote that you can use, because that's really powerful. I want to sort of zoom out for a second. And, you know, something certainly Diala and I have been talking a lot about since October 2021 is the assault on Palestinian human rights defenders on the ground, with Israel's designation of seven Palestinian human rights groups as terrorist organizations. And we're seeing increasingly violent attacks. There's always the structural violence of occupation. If people don't know what that means, you should look it up. It's really important. It's the ongoing violence that is every day, and it is inherent in the system that maintains the occupation and the, you know, unequal laws and regulations inside the Green Line and all of that. So that's all happening, right? Repression on human rights defenders, repression on Palestinians on the ground, and also an uptick, I would say, in trying to delegitimize and attack Palestinians for going to the UN, for going to the ICC, ICJ, all of that. So this is, I guess I want to know if either of you, and I'm thinking Diallo first, if you want, where do you place the lawfare in the United States against groups like US Campaign in that broader, that sort of broader picture of the effort to delegitimize and clamp down on protests writ large or Palestinian voices writ large?
Yeah, I actually see that there is a direct through line between what you're referring to. So, you know, Israel's recent designation of 6 Palestinian civil society organizations as terrorists and the U.S. campaign case. And that through line is that, you know, we all know that the Israeli government, as well as a host of, Zionist organizations like NGO Monitor, have spent years trying to build the case that these groups, you know, have an affiliation with terrorism. And the audience there isn't the Israeli, you know, legal system. It's the American legal system, right? So they have tried desperately to try to get the U.S. to designate these groups or to take steps against these groups. You know, we saw letters to the Department of Justice during the Trump administration when they thought they would have the best chance at succeeding, and they couldn't. And so they just went ahead and did what they couldn't do, what they couldn't get the Americans or the Europeans to do explicitly. They just went ahead and did it. And so. You know, what they're hoping to achieve and what we warn against now as we talk about, you know, the dismal response by the U.S. administration to the Israeli designations. What they're hoping to achieve is that by designating them under Israeli law, that will somehow trigger something in the U.S. system. And they're not wrong to an extent, because the U.S. counterterrorism apparatus is fundamentally broken. There are all sorts of problems. And one of the main features is that it gives individuals, it gives low-level agents a lot of discretion. So if you're like at the border, for example, and you're some TSA or CBP agent, or you're an FBI agent that's like tasked with, you know, reviewing files, and you just, you know, see a news article or Google some, and you land on the NGO Monitor website that says Israel has designated this group as terrorist, and you don't know any better, you're going to then, you know, do what is significantly within your authority, right? Stop and question somebody, deny them entry to the United States, revoke somebody's visa. All of these things can kind of be unleashed through this process of just like smearing somebody as terrorist, right? So even if the U.S. government does not, and it has not, and it will not designate these Palestinian human rights groups as terrorists, we still have all this like room for harm. And that's really what we need to be focusing on, and why it's important that the U.S. State Department say something, right? But the through line is the same kinds of tools that and the same kind of like theory around the U.S. campaign case is what's at play in the Israeli designation of these groups. It's the material support to terrorism laws. It's the fact that anything that is like described as terrorism lends itself to these really broad theories of guilt by association. And it's being, you know, it's Palestinians have been smeared as terrorists for a very long time. If it's not terrorism, it's, you know, and you've talked a lot about anti-Semitism being these sort of other piece of the story. So I think we have a lot of work to do here in the U.S. to ensure that the kind of counterterrorism apparatus doesn't get sort of further abused. Although I certainly am not one to sort of say that we have all of these like robust procedural protections and the system is great. We just need to get it to work right. We have critiques of, you know, the way that these laws are inherently intended to be abused in these ways, intended to be used selectively. You know, they're intentionally broad and lend themselves to kind of these like various interpretations and discretionary uses. So we have these critiques, and that's why we really need to be pushing for a more kind of affirmative position from the U.S. administration vis-a-vis the designation of Palestinian human rights advocates. As terrorists.
Yeah, I think you that through line is when you the way you explain it, it's very, very clear. I find myself casting about thinking about the case that was brought against the Carter Center, where they were accused of material support for terror for hosting a, I believe it was an event on nonviolence and protest or whatever, and allegedly Hamas people sat at the table, so they were part of the public that attended, and the case argued that they it was material support for terror by giving them cookies, water, and a platform, like they were there, they were allowed to be there, but it's I will argue, I'll say that it's both encouraging that these cases are so weak, but it is also daunting, because as soon as you throw in the word terrorism, if you're university administrators and someone sends you a letter, you know, because they want to host one of these, someone associated with a Palestinian NGO, which has now been designated a terrorist by the Israeli government, suddenly you have a whole different set of concerns. And some of them are actual litigation. You might be like, you might actually be violating the law. And some of it is just the reputational harm, is that chilling effect of, I don't want to bring in this headache. And it's just, it's constant. Ahmed, do you want to talk about that issue and what's happening on the Israeli side, or do you want to go on to the next question?
No, what Diala said.
Okay. So I want to actually, my goal with this last question was actually to give you a chance to give your mic drop. I don't know if there's something else you want to say. For Diala, I want you to come back a little bit to where we started. And you mentioned the JNF piece of it. I just want you to take a little time to just explain this further, because you have a case which is going forward. And I actually listened to the last oral arguments, which were fascinating. Folks should listen to them. I'll have a link, because really it's just so clear that this is the fishing expedition piece of it. And what is your theory of liability? Well, we don't know yet. We're hoping we'll come up with one if we get enough information. But the original case also was focused on this idea, like, because you have a case against the JNF, you have a case that's calling out the JNF, therefore that must be illegal and terrorist. And it's just, I think, difficult for people to even wrap their heads around. Can you take a moment and talk about that a little bit, for why specifically the US campaign is also being targeted here?
Ahmed, you want to start?
Yeah. Whatever you prefer, Diala or Laura.
You have the mic drop, so I should just. Yeah. Go.
I want to give him the last question, have him talk a little bit about the campaign. So I want to start with this.
Go ahead, Diala.
I'm not that good at the mic drop, so I'll stick to the technicalities here. I mean, there is all sorts of, I'm trying to figure out where to start, but.
Wait, explain the Stop the JNF campaign first.
Stop the JNF campaign. The Stop the JNF campaign is an advocacy campaign. And I can just talk about what they say it is in the complaint, because I don't want to comment about like what it is out there in the world. But I do think that there are sort of multiple efforts to call out the Jewish National Fund's involvement in the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, both on both sides of the green line. So the Jewish National Fund, it possesses or controls significant swaths of land in Israel, and it administers them under discriminatory terms, right? So only makes them accessible to, as part of its sort of mandate, has sort of like all sorts of Jewish-only provisions. And so, you know, in addition to having benefited from Israel's discriminatory use of absentee property laws, which, you know, transferred lands from Palestinian possession before the Nakba to, Jewish only hands, right? And so JNF has a role in that process of sort of ethnic cleansing. And this is something that, you know, many historians, and Iris Braverman actually has an excellent book about the use of trees, how the JNF has sort of, you know, one way to talk about it is greenwashing, but, you know, use the a tree planting project to sort of control swaths of Palestinian land and historic Palestine. So on both sides.
I'll put some links in the notes with this call about that. I'm just looking at a headline from Haaretz, which the headline is from 2021, Israel recruited the Jewish National Fund to secretly buy Palestinian land for settlers. Here's another one. This was a scoop from Axios. Jewish National Fund plans to pour millions into expanding West Bank settlements. There are tons of these headlines. And there's also headlines about the Jewish community in the United States being unhappy about this, with groups like Trua leading efforts against it. So yeah, this is not a niche issue, right?
Yes. So it's absolutely not a niche issue. And as a result, there's been sort of over the decades, Palestinian and other solidarity activist campaigns to raise this concern, right? So the Stop the JNF campaign is sort of in that vein. And so the specific, you know, the allegation around that campaign is that it is a tortious interference with the JNF's business relationships, right? And this idea that the U.S. campaign has animosity towards the Jewish National Fund. Again, here, to me, what this looks like is a target of a human rights campaign suing the human rights campaign NERS because it didn't like the fact that they're campaigning.
This would be the equivalent of, like, if someone started a Stop the NRA campaign and they were sued for having a campaign that said Stop the NRA, right? That's effectively what this piece of it is.
Exactly. And the core kind of material, classic slap suit. And again, this wasn't on appeal. They only appealed some of the claims, but it is telling, and it really does, like, complete the story of what this lawsuit is about.
Great. Okay, so last thing. Ahmed, you're going to get the last word. And here, I want you to talk about, you already talked about why you think they're targeting you and the work you're doing, but I want you to talk a little bit more about the campaign's uniqueness in the U.S. space. I mean, if that quote that I gave off the top, the International Legal Forum, ILF's, you know, going after, trying to end BDS by coming after you, it sounds like, you know, can you talk about what you're doing, what is unique about the campaign's role?
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks for allowing me to, you know, end off our conversation this way. The U.S. campaign for Palestinian rights believes that advocating for justice for all people is the only way forward. We're going to continue to struggle together towards collective liberation. This is a multi-generational fight for justice. So our grandparents, our parents' generations led this work and are continuing to help us build this movement. This is also an internationalist fight for justice that the U.S. campaign is a part of. This is an anti-colonial and anti-apartheid fight for justice that we're a part of at the U.S. campaign. And we're clear about, you know, what we work for: freedom, justice, and equality for the Palestinian people in a world without racism and oppression. We're going to continue to build towards a world in which the Palestinian people and all people can be free. If that sounds good to you, please visit our website at uscpr.org. Follow our social media at uscpr. Join up with a local organization and let's get moving towards justice. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for your support. Palestine will be free.
So that was a good mic drop. Well done. I'm going to have the links that you just gave orally. I'll have those in the notes along with everything else. I do want to make one comment here, because as we got so into the minutiae, I think maybe it got lost. And I don't know if Diallo wants to comment, but so far the U.S. campaign is winning, right? You guys won. There was a motion to dismiss. That motion was challenged by the original plaintiffs, and that failed. It was dismissed by the first court. It's now, there's been an appeal. There were briefs filed with that appeal. That actually had oral arguments a couple of weeks ago, which, again, I commend to people. You should listen to them. It's fascinating. I'm not a lawyer, and it was still fascinating. And now we're waiting for the results of that appeal as we speak. I don't know if there's any sense of the timeline for that, but that's where this sits right now. So did I get that right?
That's perfect.
Excellent. And there will be links to all those documents so people can read them for themselves. So we're going to end it here. This was fabulous. Thank you so much, Diallo. Thank you so much, Ahmed, for joining me today. I want to thank our listeners for tuning into this episode, which was long. I'm sorry to interrupt you. You can thank me at the end. Thanks for tuning in for this episode of Occupied Thoughts. You don't have to thank me, because really it's our pleasure. Please make sure to check out the FMEP website, www.fmep.org, for more content on in Palestine and Israel and the pressing issues of the day. And make sure you subscribe to stay up to date to the podcast. We have multiple podcasts every week. You can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Spotify. And then you can watch the videos on our website or on YouTube, because we do release these as both videos and podcasts. So with that, any last words, Diallo, Ahmed?
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
You have been listening to Ahmed Abousnaid, Executive Director of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, and Diala Shamis, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at WZBC 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Time, and on kkrn.org, where you can stream us live every Friday morning at 8:30 a.m. Eastern Time. If you miss a broadcast or want to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to our archive on the Internet. Click on truthandjusticeradio.org and then click on the This Week in Palestine archive. It is all there. We thank you for joining us, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.
At Truth and Justice Radio, we believe that we should bring this to an update on to what has been going on since that episode of This Week in Palestine. The update is as follows. The Center for Constitutional Rights and co-counsel filed a pretrial motion to dismiss the case back in March 2020. This was granted in March 2021. The Jewish National Fund's appeal to the District of Columbia Circuit Court of Appeals, which affirmed the dismissal in May of 2023. Last September, JNF petitioned for a writ of certiorari, hoping for escalation to the U.S. Supreme Court. CCR filed USCPR's opposition on December 20th, 2023, and the matter remains pending. We have placed a link to CCR's report on our online playlist.